Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to the second series of Let Me Tell You, the podcast series from the Irish Examiner. In this podcast, we are looking at some of the most dramatic events in recent Irish political history from the unique perspective of one of the key players. With the 50th anniversary of Ireland's entry into Europe upon us, today we want to look at the events surrounding Ireland's presidency of the EU in 2004, the enlargement from 15 to 25 countries, and the unexpected win in securing agreement on a new EU constitution against the odds. With me today to discuss his pivotal role in that period is former Taoiseach Bertie Ahern. Bertie, you're very welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
Now, before we begin, we have a short clip here that we just want to kind of set the scene for our discussion, so let's take a quick listen.
There was tight security around Dublin Castle for this afternoon's flag-raising ceremony. Members of the Cabinet, the Diplomatic Corps and invited guests were there to mark the occasion of Ireland assuming the presidency of the European Union.
For 6 months in 2004, Bertie Ahern was effectively President of Europe. It was Ireland's turn to take the chair at EU meetings, and the Taoiseach set himself the ambitious task of securing a deal on a new constitution for Europe.
He knew the stakes were very high. He knew that for a small country like ours, if we could pull it off, there would be great kudos.
There was no expectation across Europe that Ireland could bring it together. But it was an all-consuming mission for those 6 months.
Bertie, let us begin. When Ireland assumed the presidency, as Gerard Howland says there, there wasn't really any expectation of progress on our watch. Why were expectations so low?
Well, the Italians had come before us, and Berlusconi presidency, as far as the European constitution issue and maybe a number of other issues, had ended up in a bit of a fiasco. I think the last council meeting where he should have been finalising thing ended into a meeting where the people were telling stories, and that's putting it diplomatically polite. I think it ended up in that the view of the commission and the view of the Parliament and the view of the Council itself was that probably, instead of making progress in the Italian presidency, it would probably drift in for another year or so. And we had taken a keen interest right throughout that 2003 period. And we were, I had done a tour of capitals in 2003.
In advance of the presidency.
In advance of the presidency. So we were kind of across where it was. And we calculated that the Italians wouldn't get a deal and that at least we needed to be ready to take it up. Now, it wasn't that we said, well, if the Italians don't do it, then we'll definitely do it. That was not the sense. But we knew that if we didn't do the groundwork, we wouldn't be even in that ballpark.
And you described in your autobiography, and I think in some of the interviews at that time, the early days of the presidency as somewhat hopeless in terms of the moves or the prospects of a deal on the constitution as somewhat hopeless. Was it just down to the Italian presidency, or were there wider issues that were making it so pessimistic at that stage?
Well, I think, you know, the atmosphere in the council, because of, you know, the wars in Europe and the relationship with America and, you know, the Iran-Iraq thing, all of these things hadn't helped. And there hadn't been a great atmosphere within the council generally, nothing to do really with the presidency. So the feeling was that, you know, maybe the best thing was to try and leave things calm down and then to make a big effort if we thought there was a possibility. So we started talking again maybe in February to the countries, but I knew if we were to get anywhere, that I had to get Chirac and Schroeder on side,
yeah,
because they were the two big boys in the class. From, I think, about February, Bobby McDonough, who was my official at the time, who was brilliant, we were kind of a two-man show, because we said if we broaden this, you know, it's not going to work. So we set about sounding out where people were going. And Schroeder, I got on fairly well with Chirac for years because he was president of Paris when I was president of Dublin, and you know, I built up a good relationship down through the years. Schroeder was a bit more frostier character, and you know, we had to try and see if we could get the two of them on side. If we got them on side, I knew I had enough of friends in the council to be able to be helpful, but none of them had that muscle.
And what were the primary issues that were sort of presenting at the stage? Was it in terms of integration? Was it in terms of cooperation? Or like what or harmonisation? What were the big issues?
Well, and I suppose the sad thing is, even though the document is still there and the work is still there, but the whole effort of the Constitution was, because everything in Europe, as you know, then is based on, everything is a legal base. So, you know, where you can write one page, you need 150 pages. Mm. Not to say anything bad about the legal profession, but that's the way it was. So therefore, all the treaties and all the changes down the years had just got into this massive, you know, complex document. So the challenge of what we were at, and Guy Chardestan, we're to try to get the European Convention have been working in to try and keep the legal base, but to simplify it into a readable,
workable document.
Yeah. A bit like our own constitution, and even maybe a bit shorter than our own constitution. Okay.
And in terms of, was there any nervousness on your part, given that, I suppose, Ireland had gone against Nice in 2001, and there was still maybe a bit of residue anti-EU sentiment? Were you nervous about that in any way when taking up the presidency?
Well, not really. I mean, the interesting thing about the research of 2001, which is probably applicable to this day and people should remember it. After we failed to get the Nice Treaty passed, we did very comprehensive research, really detailed research. And the issue that came out number one by a mile was neutrality. Mm. And the reason we brought in the triple lock, and I hear people nowadays in political circles talking about, well, you know, what the hell did we do that from? Why is it there? We need to remember that was the reason.
The big issue, yeah.
And that was the issue. I think something like 75% of the respondents, if I recall, subject to correction. So that was the, it wasn't, the problem wasn't here. The problem was whether Europe, you know, could come behind a document like this, whether we could get the balances right. We were integrating, we were a growing Europe. What was going to happen? The new Europe, you know, we were going from 15 to 25, two more hanging around. And then there was a process called the neighbourhood Europe. So we were looking kind of moving from 15 to 40 in a different relationship. Could we put that in the constitution that everyone could agree on?
Mm. And in terms of the, I suppose, you again saying, again going back on this, that it seemed to be kind of pretty stagnant until March, but there seemed to be a breakthrough in March. You might just walk us through what
yeah,
happened.
Yeah, I think what we were, I didn't do too much travelling in January, February, because there were other issues in Europe that we were dealing with, and you know, all the various councils were on. But Bobby was sounding out, and then we had some of them from March, they started coming over here.
Okay.
And then there was the normal March meeting. And at that stage, Schroeder told me that if I could get, you know, sufficient consensus, that he'd roll
in behind you
with me. And Chirac had more or less promised, you know, he said, if you're prepared to put in the cap, but he said, remember, enlargement is the number one issue. So you have to get all the bits finished. So in January, February, we were finishing all those bits. Mm. They weren't our initiatives. They were initiatives that were around for a long time. But it all had to be, ducks had to be in a row, because the one thing we couldn't do is not be ready for the 1st of May. Mm.
So you couldn't jeopardise enlargement for
the
Constitution?
We had to get enlargement because it would have been murdered by the council, to be quite frank. So, but as soon as I was confident that we could get the March meeting out of the way and get enlargement, then we put all our focus on the next issue.
And in terms of, like, the logistics involved, because you're still Taoiseach of the country here, you're in the run into a local and European elections. I mean, how did you manage from your own diary to balance the I suppose the responsibilities of this in Europe, and then, you know, kind of minding the home fires?
Not easy. I mean, you're literally travelling all the time, and you're doing phone calls all the time in the European Union agenda. It's changed now. It's not the presidency, isn't like it was anymore. And you have to do the various summits. I mean, I did the EU Latin American summit, the EU Russian summit,
G8.
I did the Canadian one. We did the G8, which I won for the fanciest clothes.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it was all of that has to happen. So, and you still have to do the doll because the doll is moaning if you're not there on the Tuesday, Wednesday. So it was a hectic period.
And in terms of managing that, because obviously the results going into the local and Europeans, you know, Fianna Fáil obviously took a bit of a hammering in the local and Europeans. Was that, do you think, as a result of you being out of the country, or do you think there were wider issues at play in that?
No, I think there are wider issues, but I think a big part of it was I wasn't able to do the campaign in that I'd been traditionally done in 99. If you take 99, I'd done a huge amount of campaign on weekends for the local elections. In 2004, I did little or none.
Yeah.
You just couldn't do it.
Now, you mentioned the G8, and obviously that was one of the episodes in the week. It was the week before, I think, the negotiations came to a conclusion in Europe. Were you amazed the reaction that you got to the trousers, as people refer to it? Were you amazed at the reaction that it got? On a lighter note, because
On a lighter note, I was fascinated with it. But the hilarious thing about that was, Lenny, that they had this fashion magazine or something that kind of did, you know, kind of did kind of skits on politics, and they were giving out about what all the other guys were wearing, and they gave me winning prize for being the best dressed here. And at home, everyone is moaning about everything else. But I mean, that's just the way we are. People don't realise good dress. Yeah.
And that was, as I said, a week before the negotiations on the constitution came to a conclusion. I mean, what shape were you in heading into those rounds of negotiations in Europe? Were you kind of thinking a deal was likely, or
we had done, and just briefly to go back, I had done the full tour in 2003.
Yeah.
I then, for the March Council, I had to do the full tour again.
Again, okay.
And then for the third one, I had to do my third tour. Now, the advantage of that, the disadvantage was tough going on the body.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And on my team. And Bobby was on the go all the time. And our ambassador in Brussels, and, you know, generally the embassy team. But the good thing was that I had now been through it three times.
Mm.
I'd been living this now for almost 18 months. So I was very familiar with it. I was very familiar with the arguments. And I, more importantly, I had found out what the points were with all of the countries.
Yeah, okay.
So I knew four or five of them didn't have a problem. Four or five of them had every problem. Four or five of them, we had solvable problems. So what we did was, and working just Bobby and myself on weekends, we literally had it narrowed down to where the compromises were. And we, coming into the meetings, I was hopeful that we would get there. But the first day, like all these things, 2 days, the first day was a bad day. I went to bed that night not feeling
very
one
hopeful.
Bit confidence.
Yeah.
And then the second day rolled really well.
Can I put something to you? Is it a case that your experience of Good Friday and dealing with the talks in the north, that, you know, the perseverance of, you know, it might look hopeless, but you just head down, persevere, stare at a dot in the wall and keep barreling through?
Yeah, I tell you what we did, Danny, that would have been a bit different than this. When we got to a stage that I knew that the leaders would like us to do this, and remember, we had to take in the enlarged countries and we wanted to get everybody in. What I did was, with the ambassador and myself, I sat down and individually met. This was during the council meeting, just during the breaks of the council meeting, and I met every country, just prime minister and one key official. So we met everybody, said, well, you know, are you happy? What are you not happy with? Mm. You know, we want to finalise this. And went through all 25. Now, I think, first of all, I think the big thing about that, they all appreciated. Everyone was brought in. Mm. I then come down to the four or five problems. I asked Schroeder and Chirakwa to help me. And, you know, they're good guys, but they have egos.
Yeah.
So then Chirakwa and Schroeder were in. So the five problems were not just dealing with me, they were dealing with the two
big
guys.
Boys, yeah.
So it was that tactic, I think, helped me. I mean, I'm not saying I could have scored 25 of them. I knew I'd square a lot of them. But when I had Chirac and Schroeder helping me, that made a big difference.
Let's take a quick clip of Tony Blair talking about your achievements and your approach during those negotiations.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
He's a very, very sharp, very intelligent guy. And when he was negotiating, getting the countries to sign up to the constitutional treaty for Europe, which he really did, that could not have been done without a lot of really skilled negotiation.
In the end, the agreement was reached. For you personally, I mean, how significant a moment was that? When, like, you might talk us through the moment of when you rang the bell or said, you know, the deal is done.
It was great. Poland were the last to agree.
Mm.
I knew I was nearly there, but remember, I needed all 25.
Mm.
The parliamentary representative was on side. I had the commission on side, the council on side, and you're down to the last country. And then they made their case. I had argued it back. This stage, it was very much going around the table, and, you know, I'm not going to go through the 25, I'll have to say their bit in formal session. But you come down to Poland, and then he said, well, this is my problem, this is your problem. And then, you know, back forward, everyone stayed out of it. And the end, he kind of said, well, I take your arguments, I see where you've got to, I know the effort you put in, I agree. And the entire council meeting just jumped to their feet, all the countries, all the officials, all the things. So, needless to say, it wasn't that you felt like jumping up and saying I scored a goal, but you did feel like saying, God, this wasn't all a waste of time.
Yeah.
And I remember the Austrian chancellor had went around the table then, and he got everyone to sign a card, which I have somewhere, and I can't find it. But I hid it so well, I can't find it, but I know I have it. And the council secretary brought in the champagne. So, you know, you kind of realised this was a big one. And, of course, it was an enormous press conference. It was a huge press conference because it was a big thing in the debate. So,
and what impact, could I say, did it have on Ireland's standing in Europe? Because we often hear of, like, you know, we're a small country in Europe.
Yeah, I think, you know, in my belief, we have huge standing. And the fact you're there is unequal in the first place. And the fact that you're given, like, we had the opportunity that time of completing the enlargement process as a small country, one of the smallest, bringing in the biggest enlargement that probably will ever take place or ever did take place. Then being able to do a European constitution and get agreement of regards of what happened afterwards in votes, but you know it did show that I think the ability of Irish government, both, you know, our officials and our people, and it meant a huge amount to our officials. I mean, they work hard on this stuff in Europe, and they work hard in home, and I think it gave them huge credibility because, as you know, when we go to a council meeting, I might have 20. Sometimes I'm wondering why I'm bringing 20 to a council. Then you realise the French have 200 and the British have 300. And,
yeah.
You know, so it's not always appreciated at home. But do you realise for your team that this was huge? And I know people like Bobby O'Donnell who led that team, and, you know, people getting intelligence from 25 countries for 18 months. It was a huge victory for all of us.
And there was an upside for you, a potential upside for you, because you were linked then with the commission job. And we have a clip here of Barroso and Una Claffey setting out the scene there.
We reached the end of an Irish presidency that will live in our memories as a great presidency.
His standing was huge. They wanted him to be president of the commission. I mean, that job was on the table for him at the end of that negotiation. He didn't want to take it.
You didn't want to take it. Why not?
No, there were a number of reasons. I had about 18, 19 countries. I mean, I knew that. Maybe I would have had more, but I knew I had that. Mm. And half of them had come to me because we had a problem getting somebody. As you know, we had plenty of takers, but we couldn't get agreement.
Yeah.
And that was the problem. The Belgian Prime Minister wanted it. And he had the French and German support. but they couldn't deliver it from.
Okay.
And then went around, it was about four or five others. So I wasn't first choice, but by the process of elimination,
yeah.
I had 19. There were two things. One, the idea of living in Brussels effectively all the time. You know, I am a home bird. I've travelled the world and back, but as most people have travelled with me, you'll know that I'm usually halfway back before in my mind before I'm back. Mm. I don't hang around for extra hours, not to mind extra nights. The second thing, I didn't have a language.
Yeah, okay.
And that didn't make me comfortable. I knew, you know, I did French in school, but I would have had to do some crash course. I just wasn't. I used to listen to the debates in French. At the council meetings to try and prove me fair. But that convinced me was how bad I was.
Okay.
And then, you know, Barroso was a friend of mine who spoke six languages.
Yes, okay.
So I kind of said to myself, you know, you take this job, you know, I just don't think you can.
But they do have translators, you know what I mean?
You do, but I think you do need it. You do need it. So, okay. But they were the two reasons. And, you know, I said I was going to stay around, you know, till I'm 60 in Irish politics. And,
yeah.
You know, I said, well, you know, if maybe it was a well-paid job, good conditions, but.
Do you ever look back and think, on a sort of counterfactual basis, and say, had you taken that, what would have happened otherwise, say, with the tribunal and other all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I think life would have been easier. There's no doubt about that.
Do you think the tribunal would have continued at you if you were over there?
Yeah, they probably would have been, but they wouldn't have been such a nuisance to me.
Yeah.
And because when I was back here, I was so busy, I just didn't. When one my problem with the tribunal, I was so busy as teacher, I just didn't have time to be able to deal with the hundred of them that kept coming at me.
And you were, because again, going back to your autobiography, you were literally having to divert huge tranches of your day and your weekend to keep on top of the tribunal.
Weekends. They used to send me all these letters every Friday at 7.
Mm.
They delivered them on Friday at 7 just to annoy you. And, or as they say, maybe they knew I was too busy all week. I mean, I had a different view. But, you know, that's how it was. So then you spent your Sunday, you know, having to deal with this because I couldn't deal with any other time because you were in the Dáil and you were in the other things. If you're in Europe, I could have probably got the legal services. I didn't have all these legal people that they did.
And in terms of the great day in terms of the enlargement, a very important day for Ireland, you know, a showpiece day, you know, we had all the leaders of Europe there. But I suppose the glory of the Constitution was somewhat short-lived given the French and the Dutch went on to reject the Constitution.
Is that
a bittersweet sort of memory for you?
I wasn't upset about that as much as they were because I knew that when you have we've had so many referendums and you know, I think we know that when you have a referendum on anything, it's not really about the issue, everything else, and particularly if it's on a European issue. Like if you have a straightforward one on, you know, on marriage rights or abortion or something like that. It's a black and white issue. But when it comes into a complex European issue, it's going to be about everything. And that's what happened in France. I think it became an issue on cost of living issues and all kind of other issues.
Mm.
And then Luxembourg passed it, and the Netherlands were off about some totally thing to do with the monetary policy.
Yeah.
So I think that was the way it was. It was a pity, to be honest, that what was a project to simplify thousands of pages, literally thousands of pages, that we all got into a constitutional position because really we were only bringing it all together.
Yeah.
And because Europe could well do with a simplified
constitution.
Yeah.
What was the lasting legacy of that? Because obviously we went on to the Lisbon Treaty and that obviously the first Lisbon Treaty went down here and it again became an issue around commissionerships and all that kind of stuff here. What was your lasting legacy of those defeats in France and the Netherlands?
I think like people almost expected that was going to happen and it just moved on. But I think from a Europe perspective, the lasting problem is that it's still there.
Mm.
That you know, it's here. You have the whole Court of Justice, you know, wading through all kind of complex documents and agreements that are now going back to the coal and steel agreement back in the 50s, where a simplified constitution would have made life So much easier. And somebody somewhere should take it up again without having to have referendums on it, because you're not actually making any constitutional change. All you're doing is bringing it all together and simplifying it.
Is there an opportunity post-Brexit to do that now, given, or is it more complicated now?
I think, it, in fairness, it wasn't the British. I mean, the British fought over it as much as anybody else fought over the legal issues, but I don't know. It's, you know, you've different legal systems in different countries. But I think as long as Europe, and I'm not saying I'm against this, but as long as Europe, everything is based around the rule of law and about the foundations of law, everything is very complex. And that's why trying to find a solution in Brexit and trying to deal with the Northern Ireland Protocol, all these things, because everything has to be legally based. It's not like other negotiations where you can strike a deal or find a compromise. And that's the difficulty with Europe. And I think Europe will continue to have a lot of the arguments and difficulties they have until they have a simplified constitution.
And again, I suppose we're in the context not only of the 50th anniversary of the Ireland's entry into the EU, we're coming up on the 25th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement. Is there a potential for Europe again to play a part in getting the institutions back up and running? Because again, they're one of the bodies that were rode in behind it, as well as the United States. But do you think there's a way that the EU can now play a role to either get the institutions back up and running, or
yeah,
what do you think?
A crucial one, Danny, a crucial one. I think it's, I mean, the ultimate deal here has to be between the European Union and the British government, with the Irish government looking over their shoulder, even if they don't see us, and you know, the Northern parties having an involvement as well. Can Europe and the British government do this totally on their own without at least being a consultation? I'm not saying they should have a four-way consultation with the parties in the North, but you're not going to get a deal on this unless people are consulted and people are checked, and you float things with people. Like, we're talking about the European Constitution today, but would I have been able to square a deal if I didn't go around Europe three times, talk to people, narrow it down, find out, have somebody of the standard of Bobby McDonough, you know, working day and night on it? You wouldn't. And so therefore, how in the name of the divine God are you going to be able to do that in a European sense? Now, as late as last week, I met the German foreign minister. I've met several of European ministers. They still ask my views on things in various embassies. And, you know, I meet people when they're in town. I met the Speaker of the Finnish Parliament last week as well. And, you know, I've explained to them why this is. And I think they take it. And I hope that Europe... should I say that Margaret Sinkovich, I think, is a brilliant person. If ever there was a person who gets Northern Ireland, who is not from the island of Ireland, I'd give him a gold medal, because he's good.
And he's invested in his
career. He's good. He is good.
And in terms of your lasting memories of that 2004 period, I mean, what would you look back and say, like, a good moment for Ireland, bad moment for Ireland, or do you look back and kind of go, it was, you know, a significant achievement for a small country in the big, on the top table?
I think it was a big moment. I mean, the fact that all the leaders came here, Seamus Heaney's poem, you know, the ceremonies in Ars Neutron. When you meet any of the people, they still remember that. And remember, it was a huge issue around the world, not to mind in the enlargement countries, because, you know, this was, and it was in Ireland, place in Ireland, okay, it wasn't all an Irish story. But I think that was one, the constitution was two. I think getting Barroso in and managed to unite the council behind somebody, you know, they were a big achievement. And then there were a host of smaller things that you can get done as presidency when you're in office. And unfortunately, that power base that is now gone. I mean, now it's permanent people and permanent jobs. And, you know, that's easier on everybody. And you're said you have the presidency of Europe, but to be honest with you,
power is not really there.
You don't anymore. Okay. It's now just a figurehead.
Fair enough. Listen, it's been a fascinating discussion. My thanks to Bertie Hearn for joining us here on Let Me Tell You. The podcast was produced by myself, Daniel McConnell, and Paul Hosford. Join us next time for another episode. Bye for now.
On Formative, middle school kids from New York City public schools interview a phenomenal collection of grown-ups.
Me, like, I don't know what I want to do.
You don't have to have all the answers.
feel like a lot of people's favorite topics are like interest in their life.
That is a really good answer.
The podcast where the leaders of today are interviewed by leaders of tomorrow. Listen now at newyorkedge.org/formative or wherever you get your podcasts.